Welcome to Pemba On Demand. I'm Norm Chapin, your host. I am very excited to welcome you to our podcast. Pemba On Demand is produced for physicians interested in professional development. We will be discussing a wide range of topics on the podcast. I will be interviewing physician leaders from the U.S. and from other countries who have graduated from the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee. These physicians will be sharing stories of professional and personal growth, overcoming challenges in their organizations, and discussing key leadership skills they have learned from the MBA program and ongoing professional development. Hello, and welcome to Pemba On Demand, the podcast for the alumni of the University of Tennessee's Physician Executive MBA program. Whether you're sipping your morning coffee, commuting to work, or commuting home from work, or just looking for a dose of inspiration, we've got you covered. I'm your host, Norm Chapin, and today we've got an incredible guest who's been making waves in the world of public health. Our guest today is Dr. Juliana Reese, Director of Healthy Tribes at the CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention. Dr. Reese is a powerhouse in public health. Her career spans three decades and began when she obtained her master's in public health at the University of Arizona back in 1994. In 1997, she decided to pursue her medical degree and graduated from the University of New Mexico School of Medicine in 2001, and then completed her family medicine residency at UC Davis in 2004. And let's not forget that Juliana is also a proud Pemba alumnus, class of 2016. Since joining the CDC in 2021, she's been on a mission to improve health outcomes for Indigenous Native American communities across the country. So buckle up and get ready for a fascinating conversation about leadership, healthcare innovation, and what it really takes to drive change in some of the most underserved communities in America. Stay tuned. You won't want to miss a minute of this. Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of our Pemba On Demand podcast. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Juliana Reese to our show today. Juliana, we've been looking forward to this episode for a long time. Welcome to Pemba On Demand.
I'd like to start off with just a formal introduction in my Navajo language, which is customary in my culture. So, yeah, eh, Juliana Reese, you know, she, come on, Ashley, send her with me, but she's chin, kia ani, eda she chedo, a shihi, eda she nala.
Thank you.
And thank you for inviting me.
Well, you're welcome. I'm really happy to have you on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about what that means to you and the importance of introducing yourself in that way to our Pemba audience?
So I am Navajo or Diné, and I grew up in a small town in the northeast corner of Arizona on the Navajo Nation called Fort Defiance, Arizona. My father was from the New Mexico side of the Navajo Nation, my mother from the Arizona side, and we grew up with a very rich environment of Navajo culture, language, humor, lots of adversity, but accomplishments as well. And traditionally in Navajo, you are expected to introduce yourself in any setting that you go to, whether it's formal or informal, first saying your name. And then starting off with your maternal mother's clan, it's a matrilineal culture. So you talk about the matrilineal lineage that you come from. And then you describe maternal line clans from your mother's father, then your father's mother, and your grandfather's mother's line. And so obviously over time, the paternal clans disappear, but the maternal clans continue. And so if you introduce yourself with four Navajo clans, it really gives everyone in the audience an idea of what family you're from and where you're from.
It's interesting to look at different cultural aspects, whether they're patriarchal or matriarchal. How did the matriarchal culture and history in the Navajo tribes develop, if you can share some of that with us? Why is that matriarchal aspect such an important part of your culture?
Lots of perspectives on the beginning and how that happened. But in Navajo culture, everything is divided into a sort of a male and a female side, and they're both equally important, and there's fluidity kind of understood in between. But the matrilineal line is hugely important because that ties you to the earth, to Mother Earth, and to life and existence. And typically, throughout history, men would have jobs or roles in society that would really expose them to a lot more risk, whether it was hunting or warriors. And so oftentimes the men would not live very long. And so the women were often really the knowledge keepers in communities, and that maternal line was really a very part of maintaining the culture and stability of the tribe. And so different tribes differ in how they delineate their lineage, but Navajos just have a very strong matrilineal recognition, and there's lots of customs and lots of stories that go along with that.
Great. Well, thank you for a little bit of that background. So currently you're the director of Healthy Tribes Program for the Chronic Disease Prevention arm of the CDC. How did you evolve into that role? And maybe share a little bit with us and with the audience what your role is and what your day-to-day work looks like.
Okay, so I think to really answer that question fairly, I have to go back into my upbringing and my childhood. I was raised in, again, a very rich, culturally rich environment, but I also had lots of influences that sort of encouraged me to push the boundaries of knowledge and of education and of even our culture, and really explore ways to be able to survive and have accomplishments that give back to our community and continue to have our culture perpetuated in a good way. And so initially I thought I was going to be a veterinarian, an equine surgeon. I was grown up with a very rich rodeo horse culture. My dad was a rodeo stock contractor and a veterinary assistant and a very accomplished businessman on his end, and so was my grandfather. My grandfather actually discovered uranium in Brants, New Mexico, and was really that discovery was from our own tribal land near the town of Brants, New Mexico, and led to this big boom of Brants that put them on the map for a very long time. But underneath that and around that, we had very strong female role models and influences that did very important work for the tribe, for business. And so we had lots of folks that were courageous and very willing to kind of explore their boundaries and really, really maintain the culture as they did so. And so as I graduated high school and left the reservation, I had a little bit of opportunity to kind of explore what my career would be. And through my educational experience at Pomona College in Southern California, I really got exposed to the idea of being in medicine versus veterinary science, and it was very intriguing. I ended up getting my degree there in psychology, and once I left Pomona, went to the University of Arizona and pursued a master's degree in public health. And I always had a very strong interest in community-based initiatives and community health, ways that we could improve the health disparities that we see on tribal lands, and how I could learn about that and bring it back to my community to come back and serve. I ended up doing a 2-year degree there as an MPH, and at the same time did my prerequisites for medical school and went to the University of New Mexico for my medical training. From there, I attended residency in family medicine in UC Davis Family Medicine Rural Residency in Redding, California. And just all these experiences kind of culminated to really build my expertise and my knowledge base to be able to come home and serve tribal populations, or be in an arena where I was in that space looking at American Indian Alaska Native healthcare and how we could make a difference and an impact in whatever area we were focusing on. And so I'm really privileged to have been able to attend these institutions to kind of hone my skills. And I practiced for several years and doing a lot
Before
of
we
leadership. Oh, I'm sorry.
move into your practice, just one quick question. So you did your MPH and your pre-med prerequisites. Was there a gap between when you finished your MPH and when you matriculated into medical school, or did you transition right from your master's into medical school?
I actually transitioned immediately after the 2 years. I matriculated right into medical school, really with the intention of being able to use my MPH degree in a community-based format, but through medicine. I did a research project in medical school looking at the prevalence of smokeless tobacco use in American Indian Alaska Native rodeo competitors, and actually received the medical school research award for that. And so it was really a great way for me to kind of combine the learning that I had achieved from both of those worlds. But working in medicine and doing primarily clinical medicine, I would say it is a little bit of a challenge to try to bridge that public health and clinical realm. And part of that was the reason that I made several career moves moving forward to not only build my expertise even further, but to also really put myself in a position where I could be truly making an impact in tribal communities.
Now, I know from talking to you that there is a tradition in your family of native healing, if that's the right term to use. I believe your grandmother was...
Yes, my grandmother and my grandfather. Well, on both sides, they were medicine healers, my mom's side and my father's side. My paternal grandmother was, I'm sure she spoke and understood English and Spanish and a number of other languages, but she primarily spoke Navajo and really refused to speak any other language. My father and my grandfather on my dad's side spoke Navajo, of course. They spoke Spanish, Acoma, Laguna. Apache is very similar to Navajo, so they're able to communicate in Apache, and then, of course, English. So multilingual families that really had a strong traditional background and traditional heritage that was intact, yet we're still able to kind of explore other opportunities outside of just Navajo culture. And my grandmother was very versed in herbs, traditional herbal medicine. And I just recall as a kid driving along with grandma, and she would have us stop the car almost, it felt like every 50 yards or so, but we'd stop the car and she'd say, oh, let's go out and get this plant. And so we'd exit the vehicle and go hiking across the field or up a hill. And she would explain which plant we needed to pick, how to pick it, at what point of its growth was optimal. So no, don't get that one, pick this one. And if we were picking, say, even just something like Navajo tea from a field, there was a very deliberate way of doing that. You don't just pull the root up completely. You break it off at the base so it can still continue to grow, and you don't take it all. You take only parts of it. And so you do things kind of in a good way, in a respectful way to the earth, so that you are able to obtain the goodness from the earth, but yet still be able to leave the earth in a good way. And so lots of lessons along the way of different medicinal plants that she would use for all types of ailments. We rarely went to a physician growing up. My mom was very much a believer in immunizations, dental care, and probably emergency procedures. My grandma really felt like the Western medicine model really didn't have anything to offer except for antibiotics in emergency care. And so the chronic disease realm was really something that at least my grandmother felt was not a place for the Western physician, and that there were lots of gaps in how to handle chronic diseases, particularly because a lot of these didn't exist in the past in our communities. And so I think that's always been a challenge for traditional healers across the board. But yes, we rarely went to the actual medical doctor. We always went to a medicine man first, or my grandmother. And then if we needed to, the last resort was the Western physician.
So was your grandmother still alive when you made the decision to attend a Western medical school?
She was. And I actually asked both of my grandparents. All of my grandfather on my dad's side passed away when I was a baby, or just before I was born. So I grew up with a grandpa and grandma on my mother's side and my grandmother on my dad's side. And when I was sort of perplexed about what specialty I wanted to go into, one grandma, my grandma on my dad's side said, well, this idea of orthopedic medicine is really intriguing, because that's something that has always been a challenge in our communities. You know, being able to repair broken bones and save people in that way is really important, and it makes sense in that realm of medicine. On the other hand, she and my other grandmother both felt like when you go to a doctor, you kind of want your doctor to have a broad understanding of a lot of different things and be able to not just say, oh, I don't know what to do with that, you got to go to somewhere else. Although, strictly speaking, there are sort of specialists in Navajo traditional medicine as well. There are people who specialize in certain ceremonies and certain things. So that does happen. But I think the idea of having a doctor that would be in the community that would be able to see, deliver babies, take care of pregnant women, take care of kids, adults, elders, even emergencies, and, you know, kind of encompass everything, that was much more appealing and really resonated a lot more with both of my grandmothers in conversation. And so I don't think they were really trying to determine which way I should go. They were just giving their experience and what they felt would be important. And so it did shape my decision in many ways. And I really felt like if I wanted to live in my community and work in my community, it would be very difficult to do that in many ways as a surgeon, or, you know, a specialty that wasn't very supported in those types of rural environments, but that a family doctor really could do a lot there. And so that was what kind of guided my decision.
Were there other members of the community or members of your own family who viewed your decision to pursue Western education, especially Western medical education, differently than your grandparents did?
Everyone was always really excited about education in general. I was really the first of a large extended family on both sides to actually graduate from college. A number of my cousins and aunts and uncles had attended college, but no one had actually ever finished. And so the idea of having someone in the family who was going to pursue higher education and be able to potentially become a physician and come back and serve the community, that was really an important endeavor. And so people were very supportive and very aware of what that road may take. And as the eldest female in my family, oftentimes females have a very important role in ceremony and in just different community events. And so I was shielded from a lot of that just because people knew that I was in school or I was in residency, I was becoming a doctor. And so sometimes I wouldn't necessarily have agreed, but sometimes I wasn't even told about things happening because they didn't want to disrupt my path and derail me in any way. And so I think people were quite supportive across the board.
Sounds like they were protective and supportive at the same
yes.
time. Mm-hmm. That's great. That's great. I know we talked about this, but I was fascinated as we were preparing for this interview. One of the real challenges that you faced in the medical education was sort of the anatomy education and working with cadavers. And I thought that was a fascinating story in terms of how you dealt with that. I wondered if you could share that story with us.
Sure. So for those that are not aware, death and dying is a very taboo subject, at least among Navajo culture. Some cultures don't view the same things the same way. And so lots of diversity with tribes. But in my culture, it's really not something that you talk about very often. And the whole idea of going in and working in a cadaver lab, working with a dead body, those concepts are very taboo and difficult to address. However, having medicine men in my family, my uncle actually had a long discussion with me, and I had various ceremonies performed that would protect me from any ills that could potentially happen. And more than just the protection ceremonies, he really offered like this sense of responsibility and almost that it was okay for me as a healer to be in this role in medicine, Western medicine, to go in, be able to learn everything that I could about the human body so that I could then bring those skills back and use them to heal my community, use them in a good way for helping human beings. And so that notion was something I didn't hear very often, even with fellow Native students who had been struggling to figure out how to handle these situations. But my uncle didn't have any real experience in exactly what a cadaver lab entailed, but had lots of insight just in his own experience on what this may look like and what this expectation would be for me. And so described that these are our people who have donated themselves for my learning, and that this is a very important thing to respect. And that as I enter the lab, I need to acknowledge that that person has given their body and their all of this for us to learn from, and that it needed to be handled in a very respectful way. I had to learn everything I could about it. I had to be respectful in the way that I did my dissection and taking full advantage of every part that I was learning about. And the interesting thing is he asked that at the end, I needed to put everything back together for that person so that they could go back to the earth intact, which is a cultural belief in Navajo. And so I went into my first cadaver lab really feeling prepared and ready, of course, nervous, all the other feelings that most people have in that situation. But as we entered the morgue, which of course is in the basement, right? All morgues tend to be in the basement. Yes. We walk into the room, and the University of New Mexico School of Medicine did a fantastic job at kind of prefacing this exercise with letting us know who, you know, whose bodies were there and even where they were from, which could be a little bit disconcerting to some people if they were from those communities, but really kind of helping us acknowledge and respect that person for what they have done for us. And we enter the cadaver lab, and there's just lines of body bags with bodies in them, and you're assigned four to a table. And so not everyone had the same preparation that I had from my uncle, who was the medicine man. And so it was really a challenge for me to see people dissecting and doing things maybe not so carefully, or maybe people making jokes or out of just being uncomfortable. And then the most concerning part to me was, as you look to the side of the cadaver room, there were these two big green bins with signs above them that said body parts. And so people were basically getting rid of excess body parts, whether it was skin or fat or just something that was in the way of the organ they were dissecting down to, and they would those parts into that bin. And I just couldn't process that in my mind, because looking into that bin, there were multiple parts of multiple people. And it was really difficult for me to process that, because my instructions were to put everything back together and have this person fully intact as you do this whole process, and then let them go. So I had to explain that to my lab mates, and we all did our best. And at the end of the day, all the little pieces were collected and we put it together, and they were gracious enough to sort of accommodate me in that. But it was a challenging experience, to say the least.
Thank you for sharing that with us. I appreciate you taking the time to do that. So I'm sorry that I kind of interrupted your timeline here, but so you graduated from medical school and you had a plan to return to your community in Arizona or New Mexico?
Well, I was looking for really a position either anywhere on the Navajo Nation, because that had always been in my mind what I was going to do and what I wanted to do. And everything had aligned to kind of head that direction. And I ended up doing residency in Northern California at a very fantastic residency where you really got to do everything. It was unopposed, which is not typical. And compared to education.
By unopposed, I think everybody probably is aware of this, but unopposed means that you were doing a family medicine residency with no other residents in the hospital, right?
Even in the community. And so we were able to, so if a patient was admitted to the emergency room, we were able to take care of that patient. In a big university system in family medicine, oftentimes, like, the heart patients would go to the cardiology department.
Yes.
And so there's a little bit of a hierarchy sometimes in some systems. And oftentimes, family medicine would get a lot of psychiatric patients, or a lot of sort of what they call social admissions, which were really challenging patients, and got really good at handling number of chronic diseases and mental health issues, social issues, all in one patient. So it wasn't necessarily a bad thing. But in Reading, we really got to kind of take care of all kinds of patients from start to beginning, whether it was in the ICU, the emergency room, in the hospital, different levels of care. And we did a lot of surgery that you don't typically see family medicine docs do today. Delivered a number of babies. So just a really robust full spectrum training. And so coming back home to the reservation, I really expected to be able to do kind of full spectrum care. But I ended up getting recruited by a consortium of four tribes in Northern California to work in an outpatient clinic and what was intriguing about this outpatient clinic is it had a very robust comprehensive model with a dental clinic, a community health clinic, and a family medicine clinic, all connecting and doing this sort of team-based care before it was in vogue. And that was really intriguing for me because I'd had seen so many systems throughout medical school and residency that were so siloed that you really had a difficult time doing this kind of comprehensive wraparound care for patients. And so I ended up declining a very wonderful offer in Winslow, Arizona, and staying in Northern California for about 7 years to work for this of four tribes. And it was a
What were the
wonderful
four
experience.
tribes? What were the four tribes that you were providing care for?
There were Machupta, Paskenta, Grindstone, and I think there was one other related tribe that is no longer in that consortium of tribes, but really it was the entity was Northern Valley Indian Health Clinic, and they have since grown tremendously and really are a model of care for how independent tribal communities can do medicine and provide care for communities.
Was this a clinic that was funded by the tribes themselves?
So yes, so typically in the United States, we have recognized tribes, and there are probably thousands plus of federally unrecognized tribes. And through a number of treaties and agreements throughout time, treaties have been established that essentially exchanged this land for healthcare. And the interpretation of that varies depending on who you're talking to. Out of those agreements and the development of the Indian Health Service, hospitals and clinics were set up across the nation in 12 regions serving tribes across the nation that were federally recognized. Now, there are 574 federally recognized tribes today, and many are vying to become recognized, and likely that number will grow. But those that are recognized are the ones that are eligible for any federal services and programs and funding. And so that funding comes down from the government to the tribal entities. And there's essentially a spectrum of clinics. They can be fully federally run by the United States government or Indian Health Service. They can be fully independent, and very few are, but there are tribes that are fully independent, running their entire healthcare system themselves using that funding. And this funding is all from the Self-Determination Act, the Public Law 638. But the majority of tribes kind of are in the middle, where they're transitioning from fully federal to fully independent and have an array of services that are still funded directly by Indian Health Service and an array that are fully tribally run. And so this particular entity was a 638 or a fully is a consortium of tribes that had taken that federal money and were running this clinic on their own. So very
So
innovative.
you practiced with them for 6 years. Then what was the next step in your career once you got to the end of that stint?
I actually loved my job there and really enjoyed working in that very robust, comprehensive model. However, I went home for a graduation address that I was invited to do in my hometown. And as I finished the high school graduation speech, and I'm coming off the podium, I was approached by four different folks offering me a job in the community. And as flattered as I was, I said thank you. I wasn't expecting at that moment to come back home because in my mind, I really wanted to go out and learn as much as possible and then bring it back home. Stay there and not disrupt any continuity with patients and really be there to fully even retire. And so in my mind, that was my road. And I wasn't quite there. I hadn't learned everything I wanted to learn yet. And home and spoke to my husband about this experience. And he grew up in Sacramento area, Northern California, and was very excited about the idea and opportunity to move to the reservation. And I said, wow, okay, well, if that's something that you would like to do, then maybe I need to start thinking about this a little bit differently. And the more we talked about it, I became intrigued about working in my hometown, moved back to Fort Defiance, Arizona, and was the chief of family medicine there for a number of years, probably about the same amount of time I was in Northern California. And did full spectrum care to the degree that I was able to, not as much OB as I had hoped, but yes, really did a lot of ICU, did inpatient, outpatient, developed some integrated care models, pulling psychiatrists and behavioral health professionals, as well as traditional healers, into the team-based care meeting and the team-based care group so that we could all kind of manage in a comprehensive way and offer a full spectrum of care to our patients.
So it sounds like you did both ambulatory and inpatient work there. What size hospital was in Fort Defiance at the time, or is in Fort Defiance?
I believe at the time we had a 4-bed ICU and we had about a 25-bed OB and I think a 40-bed medicine floor. There was a small orthopedic team, a small general surgery team. We had some specialists that came in, cardiology, nephrology that came in on a rotating basis. We had a pretty robust behavioral health team with, I think, two or three psychiatrists and several behavioral health professionals, a very active pharmacy that was very willing to be integrated into the team-based care plan, and an ER also.
So then you practiced in that setting. I'm kind of interested now, what year did you go back to Fort Defiance?
Oh, I'm going to be dating myself now. So 2009, I went back
Okay.
to Fort Defiance. I believe I left in 2014. But yes, it was a really wonderful experience. My kids were very, very young at that point. I have two children. And so they grew up on the reservation with my family presence and ingrained in all of the cultural activities that were there to offer, or went to a school that was heavily supportive of Navajo language being integrated into the curriculum. And so they got a very robust experience in elementary
Great.
school.
Well, that sounds like an opportunity that maybe you considered less when you were moving back, but it sounds like you found real value in exposing your kids to that type of an environment as well.
It was fantastic overall. It was a lot of work. It's one of those situations where you are so passionate about the work you do and you live across the street from the hospital. So you can't help but be present all the time. I was there basically every day, whether I was on call or not. I was checking on things, making sure, and in a way that could be a setup for a burnout situation. But I found it to be really exciting and fulfilling. I learned a lot of the challenges of turnover, of just everything that comes with being in administrative role, credentialing and staffing and hiring. And so we just had to kind of do all of that. We had obviously we had a team at the hospital who did that as well, but it was part of your role to kind of have your hands in a lot of different places and really,
Sure.
I think one of the most interesting experiences that I didn't expect going home was, throughout my entire education, all I felt like I wanted to do was go home. That was always my end goal, my end game. And every opportunity I had, I would come home to see my family and attend ceremonies and be a part of community events or summer opportunities for work. And when I actually was in the community later in my career, I had this interesting experience where I felt like I had to prove myself again, all over again. I had this notion from many community members of a little bit of distrust, like, huh, well, now she thinks she's white. Now she thinks she's better than us. And so let's see if she remembers us from when, I knew her when she was this big or whatever. I knew her dad or her mom. And so it was this whole time that I had to sort of reestablish trust and connections with people and really get people to understand where my heart was and what was happening. And my husband, not being from that community, he hit the ground running. I felt like the community embraced him just like without any problem at all. We did a lot of community projects. We started a mountain biking team. We're big CrossFitters, and so we started a CrossFit-like gym on the reservation, and we coached CrossFit classes and did fitness competitions and really pulled people into different ways of looking at physical fitness and activity. And our gym is still there. It's called Maximum Output Cross Training, and you could Google it if you like. But we turned over the gym and all the equipment. We trained a number of grassroots folks to kind of teach and got them certified, and they really took over the gym as we exited a number of years later. And it was just a really fantastic, rewarding project. And I just met a gentleman in Montana on a site visit for CDC, and he remembered
Really?
our team coming to Fort Mojave, Arizona for a fitness competition they had put on at their tribe. And our
Wow.
team came all the way down from Fort Defiance, and I think we won the competition with them.
That's probably why he remembers
This podcast is sponsored by the Physician Executive MBA program at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville's Haslam College of Business. In less than one calendar year, this program will equip you with valuable business acumen and leadership development not found in traditional medical school curriculum. Are you ready to join the longest-running physician-only MBA program in the country and a network of nearly 1,000 PEMBA graduates? Visit tiny.utk.edu/podcast for information about this exciting opportunity. And now we'll return to the episode.
What about your passion for rodeoing? Did that resurface when you moved
back?
Oh my
gosh. Absolutely. I grew up with horses and animals and rodeoed my entire childhood through college. I even trained and rode horses during medical school, and I continued rodeoing, I believe, through getting an MPH and even in medical school. And so horses have always been a part of my life and my mental health. And so I ended up getting horses, and my kids rode. They
Oh,
have a
good.
very fond attachment to animals. We now have a farm. I am a co-owner of our family farm called Nijoni Farms. You could probably see that online as well. But tiny a family farm that really is based in the idea of food sovereignty and providing healthy ways for folks to kind of reclaim some of the health that they have control over through home gardens, family gardens, indigenous foods, just healthy options, and really just kind of knowing where your food comes from and why that's important. And so, yeah.
Interesting. So do you still have horses now?
My cousins have horses. We have moved our horses off of our land currently because we have to strategically rotate pastures for, we have Navajo Churro sheep that are used for wool and Navajo weaving, and also for meat and goats, and we have cattle. And so, yes, it's at this point, we are kind of in a little transition.
Great. Well,
but plenty of animals around us.
We've taken a little bit of a detour here. I wasn't planning on exploring that, but thank you for letting me veer off course a little bit. So tell me a little bit about when you became interested in really moving into the role with the CDC and how that whole transition happened. Here you are working in a fairly rural family practice setting. Sounds like a traditional family practice. You're doing inpatient, ambulatory, obstetrics, some procedural medicine, it sounds like. And then now, here you are, the director of Healthy Tribes for the Center for Disease Control in a national position. So walk us through that a little bit. How did that opportunity happen, and where did that interest come from?
So I must say there's a lot that has happened between the time that I, stopped the story and where I am now. But essentially, when I was in Fort Defiance as the chief of family medicine at Sejotza Medical Center, oftentimes, you get thrust into administrative and managerial positions before you're quite ready to do that. And in medical school, you're not, at least I wasn't taught any of that. I was taught a lot of clinical medicine, full spectrum, everything. Residency was very much focused clinically. So I'm a clinician at heart. These administrative and leadership roles have been something that's just been sort of an expectation and just really required to sort of figure that stuff out, unfortunately, and kind of make your way through. And so as I gained more and more understanding of what that looked like and what the expectations were in that role, I really felt like, gosh, I need to get more training in this particular element. I feel like you could drop me anywhere in the world and I can handle the clinical parts of doing medicine, but I don't know if I have the skills that I need to be in these administrative and leadership roles. And I do want to be able to impact change on a higher level and not just in this small hospital. I really felt like there was a lot of change that needed to happen at higher levels. And how do I get there? And so a colleague of mine, actually at Fort Defiance Indian Hospital or the Sehalco Medical Center, by the name of Michelle Peterson, had gone through PEMBA. And she was a pediatrician in an administrative role, experiencing similar concerns that I had had, like, wow, I never learned about this stuff. Is there a way I can learn more and better my skills to be able to do this job, due diligence? And so she kind of seeded me with this idea of doing this executive level MBA. And the more I started asking questions about it, I just felt like, wow, this is really something I want to do. I applied and I was accepted, and the rocket ship took off. I can say that because the PEMBA program is a very robust, condensed experience, and it was a very meaningful part of my career. Kind of helped me define a lot of things and fully understand what my role could be in that leadership place. And so, very grateful to PEMBA for that. So
So
beyond,
you.
I go back on my own accord and get my PEMBA degree, and I was actually in Durango, Colorado at that point, and I was kind of testing. I was working for another tribe. And I was sort of testing the waters in private practice, thinking maybe the grass was greener on the other side. And unfortunately, did not find that to be the case. It was very interesting because the hospital in the community, in this very affluent community, really had a lot of learning to do, in my opinion, to be able to be at the place with team-based care that the Indian Health Service had been at. And so we've been doing this model out of necessity and under-resourced situation for a very long time. And so as team-based care and problem-based care kind of became a big thing across the United States, other entities were adopting this model and trying to learn how to do it. And so I really felt like I played a pivotal role in kind of helping with their integrated care model in Durango, but at the same time, got an opportunity in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I am now, to become the chief medical officer of the Albuquerque Area Indian Health Service. And what that position entails is really kind of overseeing a full system of clinics and hospitals, all the Indian Health Service clinics and hospitals, whether they're federal or tribal, from the base of Colorado, including an urban clinic in Denver, through New Mexico, excluding the Navajo Nation because they have their own area, but all the way to El Paso, Texas. And so really gave me an opportunity to do a lot of quality work and a lot of high-level administrative work that put all my PEMBA skills to a test.
So you started that role after you'd completed Pemba, or while you were in the process of
After I
completing Pemba?
completed PEMBA,
After you
yes, I
completed.
had completed PEMBA while I was in Durango and applied for the CMO position. Ended up getting that, and I stayed in that role for a number of years when I was approached by an old I not old I should say old an older Indian Health Service physician that was actually his wife is an OBGYN at University of New Mexico, and I she was a preceptor in some of my classes and just a faculty very revered faculty member. And so he actually invited me to lunch one day, and little did I know, he was planning to retire and was looking for his successor in this Healthy Tribes role. And so we just started having a chat, and he was asking me sort of my perspective on public health, knowing I had an MPH and I had this, real sincere interest in doing community medicine. And I had done some work in integrated care and bringing behavioral health integration into many clinics. And he mentioned the term social determinants of health, and I lit up and I started talking about all these ideas that I wanted to implement, and that, timing was really an important thing in many administrative roles, and that, this was something I was really struggling with and working on. But he gathered that I had obviously a knowledge base in this area, a sincere passion and interest. And by the end of the lunch, he finally sprung it on me what the intent of of the luncheon was beyond just saying hello. And it took me by surprise. I didn't even know Healthy Tribes had existed. I realized that the Good Health and Wellness in Indian Country Cooperative Agreement was something I'd heard about in Fort Defiance and in other tribal communities, but I didn't really understand this whole network of tribal public health, particularly from that perch, from the CDC and the national level outside of Indian Health Service. And so it was such an intriguing idea. I thanked him for the lunch and I said we would talk and connect. And it was one of those things, again, I wasn't quite sure of, but I was bouncing it around and talking, asking questions, but I could not let it go. And I think one of the things that was really resonating with me is this whole idea of health equity. It really makes sense in Navajo culture because there's in Navajo culture, the concept of hojon is can be defined as like peace, harmony, balance, beauty, not just aesthetic beauty, but beauty that all things are the way they need to be and in balance. And I felt like it kind of it equates to this whole idea of health equity and how things need to be in balance and looked at from an equitable lens versus just equal lens, if you will. And so I began to ask more questions and get a little bit more information. And I really just felt like this was a calling in a place. I felt like the medical model was missing something. I had worked in primary care for so many years. And if you look at chronic diseases, there's really, if you take almost any chronic disease, essentially there's three parts of managing chronic disease. You're looking at physical activity, you're looking at nutrition, and you're looking at medical management, regardless of which chronic disease you're talking about. And I felt like we were using this Western medical model in tribal and urban communities, and we weren't really moving the needle. I mean, we had these attempts to sort of indigenize Western modalities, but it was almost like we're still putting a square peg into a round hole, and it wasn't quite making sense and resonating with the communities. It wasn't coming from the community, for the community, by the community, and it wasn't sus they weren't really sustainable. And I know chronic diseases are a challenge across the world, but we're not moving the needle much in tribal communities, and we're not really moving the needle much, honestly, in across the nation. And so I really felt like there was something missing that we could do things a little bit differently. And what Healthy Tribes offers is this opportunity to look at chronic diseases from a holistic lens instead of these siloed pieces, really support communities in the strengths that they already have innately, that our tribal communities have had for thousands of years, use those strengths. How support communities to develop their own strategies, their own solutions, and then really partner with people to really try to move things along. And this cultural piece is very important because culture, as you probably know, with all the colonization, historical trauma that has been experienced through our communities, there's a definite link between the trauma that's happened in the past, the continuing perpetuated inequities that we see institutionally and systemically in our systems, as well as our current life stressors. All of those culminate to really kind of promote these health disparities that we see, unfortunately, in American and Alaskan Native communities. And just to even know that information and relay that information to tribal communities and to patients is very powerful. And so to be able to develop an approach and a framework that resonates with our communities in a better way that incorporates cultural practices and cultural activities and really is more supportive rather than paternalistic. I was hooked with that whole idea.
How long did it take you from the time he actually made the offer until you and your husband made the decision that this would be a good transition for you? Was it a relatively rapid decision, or did you have
I
to think
think
about
at
it
the
quite a bit?
base, yeah. At the base, I knew this was a really exciting opportunity that I really needed to take very, very seriously. But it was a slow process. Nothing in the federal government moves very quickly. So even if I had applied at one point, it wasn't going to be months to a year or so before anything was going to happen. But we were already located in Albuquerque at this point because we had moved from Durango to Albuquerque. And so it really wasn't that much of a decision as far as a move for the family, but a big career move for me because, again, I'm a clinician at heart and I'd been immersed in very high level administrative and leadership roles, but I'd always maintained my foot in the clinical game. And this was going to be completely different. And how, so I still see patients now, which is, I'm grateful for the opportunity to do that. But my primary focus is now looking at that public health realm and bridging it to the clinical realm versus what I was trying to do as a clinician, bridging that clinical piece to the public health world, and that wasn't as feasible, I think, at least for me. And I think there's some more opportunity now opening up where we can kind of bridge the two and really make a difference.
When you look at chronic diseases, and you've alluded to this several times, but when you look at chronic diseases in the United States, let's say, very broadly, but the incidence of chronic diseases since the early 1900s until now, whether we're talking about heart disease or diabetes or certainly the obesity epidemic that just seems to be plaguing us and really being challenging to solve. I know that some of those same problems impacting Native American tribes, Alaskan Indians, Alaskan Natives, I should say. You alluded to the issue going back to your grandmother's belief that Western medicine is great for antibiotics, right? Acute care, if you need to have your appendix taken out or you need to have a bone set, Western medicine really brings some advantages to us. But I hear more and more conversation about whether our understanding of chronic disease, the interplay between culture, between nutrition, between lifestyle, whether this road that we're going down by breeding those conditions with pharmaceutical after pharmaceutical intervention is really addressing the root cause. What are your thoughts about that? And is it a blended thought between your Native American Navajo heritage and what you learned in Western educational system?
It's a blended thought. I mean, I'm a product of my upbringing and all my experiences of that come together. So many opinions on this, and my personal opinion it goes back to a lot of the food that we eat and the food that we have available and have access to in America. Our food systems are very different here than they are in other countries, and our food systems have been tremendously disruptive in American Indian, Alaska Native populations due to colonization and lots of things that have happened to our people throughout history. That is at the crux of a lot of it. But it's interesting because throughout my medical training, we were never truly taught. I shouldn't say never, but I don't think we got as much teaching as we should in trauma-informed care and how to talk to patients about trauma and about stress and what that means to health, to actual chronic disease symptoms and outcomes. There's just not enough information out there that is being taught and that is scientifically reliable in a way that we can make guidelines out of it. And so when I saw patients, or when I do see patients, I can tell you, I look at their chart and I already know. So, okay, this patient has five chronic diseases. They have diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, hypercholesterolemia, depression, and something else going on. I see what their medications are. I saw them 3 months ago. I'm seeing them today. I could tell you without even seeing that patient today what their treatment plan is going to be. If their A1C is this, we're going to do this. If it's here, we're going to do that. Like, I can already develop my plan, and I knew those things already ahead of time. Generally, when I saw my patients, what we spoke about mostly in my inpatient interviews was stress, financial stress, all types of stress. And it was also food and what it really does healthy mean. And people struggled most with that. Like, how do I eat better? How do I feed my family better? What exactly should I be eating? And how do I do this? And this is my budget, and this is what's available to me. And so it's a very challenging situation to be in. A lot of times we spent time talking about historical trauma and the connection of trauma throughout families, current trauma, stress, and how that impacts your life. There's a lot of really interesting information coming out with epigenetics and how prolonged trauma actually changes your brain and can be passed down through your DNA. But no one talks about how this can actually be changed back also. It can change one direction, but it can also go the other direction. And that's where public health and medicine need to come together, because we're sitting on a gold mine of how can we move this needle back the other direction, if you will, with regard to some of these things that people have limited access to in life, and to be able to have a healthier have healthier living, you have to have access to healthier foods and water and electricity and plumbing and broadband and all these parts that go outside of what you think you need to do as a physician in the clinic. And so public health addresses 80% of those social determinants, whereas clinical care, if you look at the 20% of clinical care that really relates to health outcomes as far as length of life and quality of life, we're investing in our country more like 80% to the clinical care when really we're only going to get that 20% out of that. It's the 80% that we need to kind of look a little bit more closely at. And so I have lots of thoughts on that, as you can tell, but I really feel like helping providers to understand stress and the impact of stress on health, really getting people to understand what real food is. I would tell my patients, I'd make it as simple as possible. I wouldn't tell them this diet or that diet or this, or it would be real food. If it wasn't around 200 years ago, you probably don't want to put it in your mouth. You know, think about what is margarine. If you look at the chemical composition of that, it's one step away from plastic. You know, what is that doing to our bodies, and how is that being interpreted by our cells and our systems? And so there's a lot that goes into teaching the community about what is healthy, but what I want to do is not complicate things and make things difficult by just talking about real food and going back to maybe some indigenous foods that our bodies are more familiar with, and incorporating as much knowledge and access to their day as possible. Those are kind of the goals that I shoot for.
I think there's a couple things that you've said that really kind of resonate with me. A few years ago, I had a conversation with a naturopathic physician. I think it's always interesting to me to have conversations with people who have been trained in different disciplines. And he was talking about some of the research that is coming out of what most Western physicians, American trained allopathic physicians would feel are pretty reputable sources, such as Johns Hopkins and Cleveland Clinic. And he talked about some studies that he did, or that he was aware of, I should say, on the genetic makeup of different ethnicities, Italians versus Norwegians versus Hawaiian Island, Pacific Islanders and that type of thing. And if you look at how they process different foods and how they might process their indigenous diet versus a Western diet, you can see some dramatic changes in terms of how their genetic makeup influences how detrimental some of those dietary changes, like adopting a Western diet, might be to them. And he and his wife were from different ethnicities. And it always, one of the stories he told was that when my wife and I went through this testing process, we realized that she could handle sweeter desserts like ice cream and those kinds of things than I could. It just, our genetic makeup was just different. And I think it's interesting that you're bringing that element out as well. Not all of us react the same way in our epigenetics and our background. Historical ethnicity can play maybe a bigger role than we've ever really appreciated. But we do know that some societies have very different incidence of these chronic diseases. And I think I do get concerned that our approach to them has been very much peanut butter spread, with just giving everybody the same treatment for hyperlipidemia and the same treatment for type 2 diabetes. And where the question is, are we really addressing maybe some of the root causes of those types of problems and taking into account the differences between different ethnic groups?
I think the medical model is flawed in many ways, and I'm a scientist. I'm a physician. I understand that world to some degree, I guess. But it's really disheartening when you have a native patient talking to you, missing appointments, not coming in. Finally, they come in and, "Hey, where have you been? How are you doing?" And, "Oh, you know, I just..." The reluctance, more often than not, that I was seeing in my clinic was that people felt guilty or ashamed or embarrassed of having a chronic disease. Now you don't have that stigma with cancer or with other diseases. And people would come out right out and say, "Oh, I thought I had diabetes or obesity or hyperlipidemia or heart disease because I am Native American. And I was like, no, I thought it was because I just wasn't eating right or exercising. Like it's all their fault. Actually, I mean, those are some components that come together, but it's very multifactorial. And this whole element of stress and inflammation and food, and there's so much more to it, and what people actually have access to, and why our communities are set up the way they are, and why certain zip codes have a shorter life expectancy. I mean, all of that is real data. And it doesn't just mean it's because you're American Indian Alaska Native. It's a lot bigger than that. And I think once people start to understand that, they can make better decisions for themselves. But we can, as healthcare professionals and folks in influencer positions, can start to promote different ways of doing things and better access for everybody. So the one size fits all model surely doesn't fit everyone.
So, how does Juliana Reese take this mindset into the Centers for Disease Control? And how does she use that mindset and that knowledge that we were just talking about to shape our response to the Healthy Tribe program?
How do you answer that question? I approach this very carefully, always listen first, but I believe I have a lot of valid and important information to contribute. And the way that some of these ideas are realized is they're embedded in the framework of how we work with communities. It's all about establishing trust first. It's about acknowledging the strengths of the communities. There are so many Western sciences wrought with this whole idea of a kind of a deficit-based model of collecting information, of showcasing information. And sometimes you need to highlight these staggering statistics in order to, say, receive funding or to get attention and support in certain areas. But there needs to be a balanced narrative there. There needs to be a way to do this that contributes to the communities and doesn't perpetuate negative stereotypes. And so this whole idea of real food and food that resonates with your community, and the idea of cultural connectedness is something that we're really, really working on in Healthy Tribes. We know social connectedness is a social determinant of health, and it's very much a goal for public health professionals and clinicians as well. And we know the power of social connectedness, but within that concept is also this concept of cultural connectedness, and really getting to a place where you resonate with your patient, with your community, with your population, and utilizing those strengths based in culture to lay the foundation for anything else that you add to it. Whether you take the good things from Western medicine and you integrate health interventions, and that the foundation has to be there first, and it has to be laid by the community. And so I think it's our framework. It's how we go about doing the work that we do. And it's very different. I believe what we do in Healthy Tribes is very different than any other place in CDC. And so we are forging ground. We are trying to establish the scientific credibility that culture equates to health. And honestly, if this model does get scientifically established, what that does, it's not for us to have that notoriety or to publish a paper. Really, what it does is it supports tribal communities to be able to get more funding and get more support for the things that they already have told us they needed and wanted. The reason these ideas exist is because we received input from tribal communities and tribal leaders, and we're moving along, being prompted by the input that we receive from these communities that we're serving. So they're not my ideas per se, but we are forging new ground so that we can support this model that we really feel is going to be fantastic, and it will be something that you can implement anywhere. Every population has a culture, not just American and Alaska Native communities. It could be another tribe across the world. It could be another community in Europe. It could be a military community, a student population. So there's a culture in each of these places. And if you tailor your message to resonate with that community and that population, you have a lot more opportunity for success and, more importantly, for sustainability.
It's fascinating. One of the last questions I wanted to ask you, in terms of the Healthy Tribes program, what are your main points of contact when you're trying to innovate and make a difference? Is it with individual physicians or providers of healthcare? Is it with state governments? Is it within the federal government itself, or is it within tribal governments or tribal organizations?
A small but mighty team. I'll start with that. And all of those places are important. And so we do have to prioritize based on the task at hand. Our primary audience that we are obviously serving and responding to are the tribal communities, the urban Indian organizations, our tribal recipients that receive our funding. But beyond that, we want to partner with programs internal to CDC because we have so much to offer with technical assistance and support and expertise in CDC. But the learning goes both ways with that, right? We have external partners. We have interagency partners with HHS and IHS, NIH. So there are tribal organizations that are representing tribes across the nation. We have just partners everywhere that we're trying to connect and also connect our recipients who are receiving this money or this funding to these resources so that they could complement and supplement what they're getting from CDC. Because we all know the amount of money that people receive is not enough. It could always be more. And so our goals are to be able to grow the program, to expand the program, and to really promote what we're doing so that we can get support to support the tribes that we are serving.
Thanks for spending so much time with us today. I'd like to be able to share some information with our audience about where they can go to get more information. So if people are looking for you, where can they find you? Where can they connect to you? And if people are looking for more information about Healthy Tribes Program, what are some of the resources that you would recommend for them?
I can be found on LinkedIn, Juliana Reese. And I also have, you can find me on cdc.gov/healthytribes. There's a link there that talks about our program, talks about a number of things we do. And I believe there is an opportunity there to send an email. I'm happy to connect with anyone at any time. I'm often at conferences and am looking for networking and opportunities to partner and connect. If there are students, healthcare professionals, fellows, residents, people interested in having some opportunity to work in CDC and maybe learn a little bit about what we do and contribute to their careers in that way, we have fellowships, we have student internships. There's a number of opportunities as well as career opportunities. So usajobs.gov is a place where you can look for opportunities in public health, and there's plenty available for physicians, for researchers, for scientists, and public health advisors. So I would encourage you to go to any of those sites.
Great. And we'll include some of those sites in our show notes for you so that you can access them there as well. I'll put Juliana's LinkedIn profile connection there, as well as some of the CDC sites that she described. So thank you so much again, Dr. Reese, for joining us today. I've enjoyed this conversation immensely, and I appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. I know it's been a little bit of a challenge for us to find a time when your schedule would accommodate this, but I appreciate your diligence and your persistence.
Thank you so much. If I'm anything, I'm persistent. Thank you again very much for the opportunity.
You're welcome. It's been a real treat having you on.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Pemba On Demand with Dr. Reese. I enjoyed preparing for the interview and discussing with Juliana her career and the unique challenges she faced as a Native American, bridging traditional healing with Western medicine. I look forward to having Juliana on a show in the future to discuss some of her more specific approaches that she has implemented while working at the CDC. Pemba On Demand podcasts are released bi-monthly on Thursdays. Please subscribe to Pemba On Demand using your favorite podcast player. Please join us in 2 weeks on September 19th, 2024, for the dual role of AI, enhancing medicine and personal lives, with guest Dr. Harvey Castro from our August 20th live stream. Our October 3rd podcast will feature Dr. Hank Schiffers. Hank and I will be discussing the challenges faced by physician entrepreneurs as they determine how best to bring a product or software innovation to market. Don't miss our next live stream at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time, featuring Dr. Jay Greiner discussing The Path to Excellence, a physician executive's story of challenges and successes. Then Dr. James Calvin will be joining us on October 15th, 2024, discussing development of a center for quality, safety, and innovation, drawing from his experiences and leadership during his 10 years at Western University. The live streams are always at 12 noon Eastern Standard Time. Tom Brown will send out email invitations so that you can join by Zoom. You can also view the live stream on our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PembaOn-demand, all one word, no spaces. Please don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click the notification bell to be notified of our upcoming live streams. Thank you very much. That wraps up our show for today. Thank you very much for joining and listening to the podcast. If you have any comments or questions regarding this episode, please feel free to add them in the comment section on our website, tiny.utk.edu/podcast. We love hearing from you and are happy to answer any questions you may have. I will add a link to the website below. Please also don't forget to subscribe to the podcast by clicking the subscribe button. Add Pemba On Demand to your podcast library today. I would also appreciate it if you could leave a review of the podcast on your podcast player. Share the podcast with your friends and colleagues also. Please take good care of yourselves, and as always, good luck with your future.